Hello, and welcome to this Control Risks podcast. This time, our focus is on social risk. I'm Evan Kaplan, and I'm joined today by Simon Whistler, Practice Leader for Global Risk Analysis in the Americas, and Oliver Wack, our Lead Analyst for the Andean region. Gentlemen, social risk is nothing new. Companies have long understood the potential for political protests or poor community relations to affect their bottom lines. But it's an issue that is increasingly being talked about. How do you see it specifically in the Latin American context?
Well, we've seen in Latin America that the social risk has been seen in different forms across different countries in the region for many years. But I think it remains most prominent for natural resource projects. In other words, projects involving the extractive industry, mining, oil and gas, and also major hydroelectric operations in particular. And the intersection of where those kind of projects face up with indigenous communities in the region. So you're particularly looking at countries in the Andean region, Bolivia, Peru, Colombia, and parts of Central America, such as Guatemala. But I think it's important not to be too simplistic about this, as the drivers behind levels of social risk in a particular country is also different. In Bolivia, for example, and to a lesser extent Peru, social risk has become more prominent in large part because of changes in the overall political landscape, and particularly the rise of politicians. In Bolivia, you have President Evo Morales, who owe their position in large part or espouse overtly pro-indigenous or more socially inclusive agendas. In contrast, you've got countries like Colombia, where social risk probably wasn't a major issue even 5-10 years ago, but is now emerging as a matter of considerable interest because companies are gradually seeing that the security situation is improving, and that's meaning that other risks, such as social risks, are coming to the fore.
Thanks, Simon. Now, Oliver, what are you seeing as the main drivers for the rise in the importance of social risk?
In addition to some of the factors that Simon mentioned, I think globalization is one of the main drivers. It means that networks between local community organizations, indigenous groups, national advocacy groups, and international NGOs are becoming much stronger. On the one side, while media coverage of local community issues is becoming far easier. So on the one hand, this means that local social issues regularly find their way onto the agenda of politicians or other interested parties at the national level, which clearly raises the operational and reputational implications for companies. But on the other hand, it also means that problems resulting from companies' difficulties with local communities very quickly find their way back to multinational companies' home countries, where they add further stress and can carry reputational and, in some cases, even legal implications. And finally, as a result of globalization, as a result of these networks, communities today are increasingly well-informed and know what their rights are, and they know when they're being violated.
So what are the big pitfalls when a company is trying to manage its social risk? What factors might raise its risk?
So for starters, I think quite frequently companies don't define clearly what they're trying to achieve when they speak of managing social risk. Among others, we frequently see CSR or community relations departments operating somewhat independently from other parts of the company, a point that's frequently reinforced because people in those departments often have a very different background and different philosophies or convictions from their colleagues. And the problem is that social risk management must be an integral part of the company's overall risk mitigation strategy, and it must be clear that the work being done by all departments, and that includes the CSR department, serves to reduce the overall risk to the project. So in a way, adequately managing social risks doesn't only have to do with philanthropy, it's also good business. One thing that I think it's crucial to highlight is that when we talk of social risks, by no means do we propose seeing communities themselves as threats, similar to, for example, security threats or integrity threats. Rather, threats associated with communities and with social risk usually emanate from mismanaged relationships with these communities.
Yeah, I mean, overall, it's a difficult question to answer because, frankly, there are a host of issues that can undermine companies' relationships with communities, even among the most well-intentioned companies, and they can come up at any given stage of the project lifecycle. And I think that particular point is most important to remember. I think one thing that we frequently see is that efforts to manage social risk, manage community relations, stumble because they're not necessarily updated over time. They don't take into account changing circumstances around particular projects. At Control Risk, we often use stakeholder mapping exercises as a key part of helping companies understand what the level of social risk facing their project is and how to, from that exercise, how to develop appropriate community engagement strategies. What we see with a lot of these exercises that companies carry out is that they fail to reveal the true levels of both power and influence of different stakeholders, which obviously complicates managing these stakeholders adequately as the project progresses. And one key element of this is that stakeholder mapping is often seen as a one-off exercise as opposed to being regularly updated and adapted. And where you've got, in particular when you're talking about indigenous communities, where traditional power structures such as we understand them involving elections and kind of people of influence aren't necessarily so clearly defined, it's really important to follow these developments on a very regular basis. And finally, one unfortunately fairly frequent mistake that we see is the belief that an approach that worked very well in place A will work just as well in place B. Differences in culture, customs, language, social and economic conditions, sometimes even within the same country or even within the same region, mean that social risk management strategies must necessarily be adapted and where necessarily completely overhauled depending on the very specific circumstances around a project.
So Simon, to that last point, how useful are international standards in informing best practice?
I think international best practice standards like the Voluntary Principles on Security and Human Rights, the IFC Performance Standards, and others, and there's any number and a growing number that are out there that companies use, they're very important starting points, but it's important to remember that they're not risk management strategies. And I think companies often tend to confuse the two in the sense that they feel that if they are compliant or seem to be compliant with, say, the VPs or the performance standards, then they've done that part of social risk management. And I think there's two sort of particularly important points to remember as part of that. Firstly, that these frameworks generally don't have a legal standing at the current time. There are moves in that direction in some countries and at an international level as well. But when you have a problem with a community or from a social risk point of view, it doesn't stand up to say that because you followed this or that guideline, then you're somehow off the hook for mismanaging community relations down the line. And that also feeds back into the point we were making earlier about this needs to be a constant process. A lot of these assessments, a lot of this kind of adherence, compliance with international best practices is done at a certain stage of a project. A number of projects that are perceived to have a significant social or environmental impact require having an assessment against, for example, the IFC performance standards or something called the Equator Principles in order for large financial companies or international institutions to be able to invest in them. And so these assessments are done at the initial stage of project financing and before the project is actually undertaken, but then not necessarily repeated or monitored further down the line.
So Oliver, what's the bottom line? What should companies do to mitigate their social risks?
The main thing is to understand and to assume that the issue of social risk is really transversal, which means that it sits not only with the CSR or with the community relations department, but it sits with many different internal stakeholders. For example, we've seen numerous cases where social risk has actually increased, not because of shifts in the company's CSR policies, but rather because of changes in the company's security setup and procedures that reverberate negatively with communities. And on the other hand, whenever these two elements are properly integrated, so when the social risk management function understands what the security function is trying to achieve and supports this work, and vice versa, then overall project risks, including the social risks, can be very well mitigated. We recently saw a great example of this with one of our clients, a Norwegian power company operating a hydroelectric project in Peru with very minimal disruptions from local communities because of this proper integration of the different functions that reduce overall project risk. Finally, I think the entire social risk management structure must be given power within the organization and receive adequate levels of support and buy-in from senior management. And senior management must understand that social risk management is a key component of overall project risk management. And again, the key point here, I think, is that doing so, that including and that assuming that social risk plays that key role in your overall project risk management strategy is sound business practice.
I've been speaking with Oliver Wack and Simon Whistler. For more information, visit us online at www.controlrisks.com.